Good afternoon. Welcome to this afternoon's NAESP webinar on helping parents help in distance learning. At this time, I would like to introduce NAESP's Associate Executive Director for Professional Learning, Gracie Branch. Hi, Gracie.
Hi, Honor, and thank you. It's great to be with you all this afternoon, and we really have a surprise in store for you. You thought you were just going to see Dr. Doug Fisher today, but we've got his counterpart, Dr. Nancy Fry. So I'm going to do a brief introduction of both of them to start off the webinar. Dr. Fry is a professor in educational leadership at San Diego State University and a member of the International Literacy Association's Literacy Research Panel. Nancy has published in The Reading Teacher, Principal, Middle School Journal, and Educational Leadership. I'm very envious of all those publications, Nancy. She and colleague Doug Fisher have co-authored the Distance Learning Playbook, the Distance Learning Playbook for Parents, and the upcoming Distance Learning Playbook for School Leaders with John Hattie. She is the credentialed special educator, a reading specialist, and administrator in California, and is a co-founder and administrator at Health Sciences High and Middle College. But one of the most interesting things Nancy shared with me before the webinar was that in her neighborhood, some of their best friends were called the Burgers. So it was very interesting making reservations for their families when they called to have reservations for the Burgers and Fries. That was pretty cute. I want to go ahead, and he'll be joining us probably in just about 15 minutes, but Dr. Doug Fisher is professor and chair of educational leadership at San Diego State University and a leader at Health Sciences High and Middle College, having been an early intervention teacher and elementary school educator. He's the recipient of an International Reading Association William S. Gray Citation of Merit and Exemplary Leader Award from the Conference on English Leadership of NCTE, as well as a Krista McAuliffe Award for Excellence in Teacher Education. He's published numerous articles on reading and literacy, differentiated instruction, and curriculum design, as well as books such as PLC Plus, Better Decisions and Greater Impact by Design, Building Equity, and Assessment Capable Learners. So please welcome to lead off Dr. Nancy Fry.
Thank you so much, Gracie. Thank you for having me here. And I have to say, first of all, that Doug and John and I are super excited about this work in working with parents. And there might be a name on there that you don't necessarily associate with us, and that's Rosalind Wiseman. And Rosalind has been so important to us in being able to really bring that parent perspective. You probably know her work through things like Queen Bees and Wannabes, which turned into the film and the play Mean Girls. Rosalind has really dedicated her life and her profession to being able to support parents, support children and adolescents as well. So we're super excited about this. I will go ahead and say just a couple of things about this work as we go forward. What Rosalind was able to do was to bring alongside all of her teen editors to be able to screen for us our own writing as it was going on. And it was great to be able to have those perspectives from young people as well. In addition, we worked with a pediatrician, with a former director of the CDC, as well as a number of parents of children, both elementary and secondary, to be able to bring this product together. So I'm really excited about all of that. As you all know, too, parents are really desperate to try and find out how is it that they can help and what it is that they can do. And they, as much as anything, don't want to do the wrong thing, right? And here we are in this school year, and we're all figuring out in real time as well what those processes really should be. We don't have a crystal ball to be able to foresee what it is that this school year is going to look like. And depending on what region of the country you're in, you're experiencing as school leaders anything from full-on distance learning. I know here in San Diego, that's where we are right now. Many of you, I imagine, are in some kind of hybrid scheduling where you have students on campus certain days of the week, but online on other days of the week. And perhaps in some cases, some of you may be even doing some full-time face-to-face learning, but it's not like last year, right? It's, we've got so many different protocols that are happening. And as school leaders, we're really challenged to be able to respond in ways that work for our communities, work for our children, and work for their families as well. And those families are an important component of that. You know, when we engaged in March of this past year with the kind of rapid change that we had to make, it was nothing short of heroic in terms of what it was that educators all around the globe did. Most of us had a weekend to be able to keep learning going in one way or another, from face to face to moving into an online environment. And I do want to draw a bright line between the heroics that happened with educators and what it is that we're doing now. Let's call it quarantine teaching. Let's call it pandemic teaching. That was an emergency. What it is that we're doing now is having that opportunity to be able to really think about how it is that we collaborate, how it is that we move everything forward in a more cohesive kind of way. And that's really an essential change from what it was that we needed to be able to do this past spring. However, there's going to be, chances are very good, some element of distance learning that is happening in your school and in your district. And parents, as I said, are an essential part of that. When you take home and school, you're really talking about those two stabilizing forces that are in a child's life. And now more than ever, it's so important that we come together as a network around those children to be able to ensure that to the best of their abilities, they're able to continue learning. They're able to continue to have that social and emotional growth that's needed. But we also know, too, that there has to be a coordination of effort that's happening there, home and school, those two stabilizing forces. Having said that, they're not the same. School isn't home and home isn't school, but we're really seeing kind of a blurring of those lines, at least in terms of setting. And we want to be able to tap in to the strengths that each of them have to offer. So I'm going to pose a question to you that for you to be able to respond to in the chat. I'm going to show you another slide in just a moment about differences between those two roles, between being a teacher and being a parent. And I'd love to hear from you in the chat. What do you notice about the differences in those roles? Rodney offers one is more rigid and one is more flexible. And what parents bring to the equation, as Charlotte noted, is that real grounding in social and emotional development. John, I love your analogy about the teachers being the push and families being the support. There are a lot of commonalities as well, but there are some important differences, and I think helping families to understand that what it is that they do is of incredible value. And Elena, I agree with you. Parents have a hard time watching their children struggle. In fact, that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about during our time together today. I've heard from many parents around the country that have said, you know what, I know a whole lot more about what it is that my kids are doing in school. That in the past, they would send their children to school and it was kind of like a black hole. You know, things happened in that school building, but then they didn't really know until the end of the day and they try to have a conversation. And now, in the case of distance learning, families are really getting a sense of what it is that is happening in school. And Rachel, as you noted, that one big difference that you're seeing in your district is that parents have to educate themselves as well as be able to help their kids along the way. There's a duality there. There's a pressure that's there that we want to, as much as possible, alleviate for families to the extent that we can, so that they can do all of these really important things that need to happen. Those two support systems are absolutely critical to what it is that children need in their lives, those two support systems of school and of home. The way that we've kind of gathered up this information and what we'll be talking about today include things like the basics. What are those essential actions that parents can do that really do support their child's learning? And what are some research-based practices that you as a parent might consider doing if that is something that you're interested in doing? We found a lot of response to that third section about principles of well-being for yourself, your child, as well as your family. And then finally, talking about the mind frames that we want to be able to build with our students, as well as build with our families so that they can foster that kind of emotional growth and intellectual growth. Now, one of the things that we're offering today is a parent portal, and we're going to make this available to all of you. It's free to all of you, and this parent portal is something that we've just opened up. You'll see the URL that's there as well as the password. I'm going to give you a little tour of the portal itself because we're adding information to it all the time, but I want you to be able to see what some of those features are that you have in that portal. So let me get the portal up. There you go. That's exactly what it looks like. And in the chat, we're going to post again what the URL is as well as the password. Thank you so much. It just went in there. And some features that you'll find in there include, if you click on content, what we have set up are PowerPoints for you to be able to utilize, and of course, chop these up and make them your own for book clubs to be able to support parents at your school or in your district to be able to bring those together. As I said, you can mash them up, make them your own as much as you would like to. You'll find in on those PowerPoints that many of the PowerPoints that we're utilizing today are right there for you as well. There's also a discussion guide that's in there to help guide some conversation with your families that you're working with as well. So we want to make sure that you have those opportunities to be able to use that parent portal and to be able to continue to go back to it. As I said, Doug and I continue to add to all of that information that's in there. So I'll put the URL up there again for you as well as the password. Another thing that you can do if you like is just take a quick snapshot of that too if you'd like to have that. And thank you so much. I appreciate your kind comments about that. You know, Doug and I, we work at a school as well. We have families who are asking lots of really important questions about that. And so what we wanted to do was kind of start with talking about what some of the basics are. What are some of the things that families can do that families often do, but they may not realize just how very important they are for us. Sometimes families kind of minimize what it is that they do when it comes to the contributions that they have for their children. One of the things that we ask parents is have your student dressed and ready. Even if they're in distance learning, we want them to be able to have some of those routines that help to bracket their days. That's a really important aspect of that. And we know that in over this last 6 months or so, in some cases, some of those routines have kind of slipped at home. But those routines are essential for children to be able to benefit from the learning that's happening. We also want to encourage them to be able to create a learning environment. That learning environment does not have to be anything elaborate. We, Doug and I both work in a community that is a highly stressed community. We have families that are living in very small spaces in particular. We're not necessarily talking about you need to have like your own dedicated space just for them to be able to do so. And in fact, what we do ask families to do is to just be mindful of a couple of things about that learning environment. One is your children don't have to be alone, but they do need to be away from distraction. It really is okay for, if you have multiple children in the home, to go ahead and work together, but maybe some headphones might be helpful. And we remind families at our own school, if you need headphones, we'll get headphones to you. We're not asking families to go out and purchase them on their own. But kind of minimizing some of those distractions can be helpful. This, by the way, is usually the time when we maybe slide in there a little bit of just a mention of, hey, don't run the vacuum while your kid is in the same room and he's trying to do his math. Just be mindful about all of that. We ask them if it's possible, if you keep them out of the bedroom. We know that that's not always possible. But in particular for very young children, it can be a little bit challenging for them to be able to differentiate what is a place for play versus what is a place for school. Now, as I said, staying out of the bedroom isn't always something that is a reality for every family. But even if they are in the bedroom, just having a little dedicated corner, a little space for with a writing surface for them to be able to write on, and just a bin or a basket where they're able to store those supplies, that can be really useful. In addition, we get lots of questions about screen time. I imagine that you do as well. And the interesting research on screen time, and you know, we've all seen those reports and things like that, is that screen time has typically been measured by recreational screen time. In other words, time spent in front of a television or playing video games and so on. Not for schooling. We haven't had this kind of experience before. Having said that, the American Academy of Pediatrics has several years ago kind of scaled back on their one-size-fits-all approach for children. For very, very young children under the age of 5, there are some pretty specific recommendations that are time-bound. But for students of school age, what they recommend instead is that families make a media plan that works for them. And I put the URLs there in both English and Spanish for the Academy of Pediatrics family media plans. In other words, not everything is the exact same fit of rightness for every single family. Instead, what they encourage, what we encourage, is that families have a conversation about what works best for them. We do ask families to consider some questions in terms of just the balance of how it is that you make those screen time decisions. It isn't all about what the neighbor's kid is allowed to do or not allowed to do, but rather we encourage families to ask themselves, is your child playing? In other words, are they actually engaged in play that is away from the screen? Is your child interacting with other people? Are they, for instance, doing their chores, doing the things that make them members of the family? Do they talk with other family members as well? What the neighbor kid is doing isn't necessarily exactly the same as what your own child is doing. And so making that media plan can be really useful for them. So just some takeaways kind of at the at that level. Screen time isn't necessarily good or bad inherently. We want families to be able to look at what those effective apps are, but to also be a bit cautious as well. If your child is using technology a lot, make sure that they get some breaks in there. Teachers are great at being able to make sure that students get up out of their chair, they get up, they move around, and so on. And families can do that as well. And honestly, make sure that your child has some reading materials that are just printed on good old paper, that not everything needs to be read off of a screen. And Doug, I see that you're joining us as well. I was just going to go into talking about sleep.
Excellent.
So what we've seen, as I had said earlier over the last several months, is that children are sometimes not having as predictable sleeping patterns as they once did when they were in physical schools. And it's important to alert families to the fact that if you're seeing your child having some mood disturbances, some emotional instability, some behavior problems, it may be in part exacerbated by irregular sleep patterns. And we know that even physically there are issues with that as well. Lack of sleep can contribute to obesity at any age. We consulted with the Sleep Foundation about recommendations for sleep and what their ranges of what are recommended, what might be appropriate, and when it is that it might be cause for alarm. What we typically do too when we ask about this is that we remind families as well to make sure and look at what their sleep patterns are, because their sleep patterns are as important as their children's sleep patterns. Again, kind of going back to that idea of just routines and having those routines in place is a really important part of this. And for some families, they may need to do a bit of scaling back. Our recommendation typically is that if you're trying to readjust your child's sleeping time, scale it back, 10 minutes a night, just moving backwards. Don't suddenly announce, hey, everybody has to go to bed at 7:30. But in addition, add back in some of those nighttime activities. Maybe it is reading a story or some other routine that helps to signal that it is getting time for bed. And of course, remembering that children should not have access to electronics for at least an hour before bedtime. By the way, that's great advice for all of us as well. And in addition, we also want to make sure that those routines are there. We collaborated with Claudia Reedwright, who is just a terrific primary instructional coach in Fresno, California. And she talks about how it is that they put together any number of materials to help families as well as their young children with being able to know how it is that you get ready, what some of those routines are that are so important. So we'll turn this back to you for another chat. How might you support parents and families in some of these basics around the importance of sleep, for instance, the importance of routines and so on?
And if you're wondering about like the hours, the Sleep Foundation says it's really hard on students, young people, if they have odd sleeping patterns, like they can't go to bed till midnight for whatever logistics reason. But the total of number of hours is still really, really important. So how can you support parents in these basics? All right, Nancy? The second section is, we called it the value of. So if families have some time to help, schedule the lessons. Yes, Dawn. When you schedule the lessons, are you interrupting the sleeping time? Provide some workshops for them. And use the PowerPoints. They're free. Have at them, that Nancy shared with you. Have at them. Flexible when the lesson turn-in times. So in the second section, we're talking about the value of. So if parents have a little time, more time, a lot of time, we're not asking parents to become the teacher. We're asking parents to support the learning. And one of the things we'll start with is reading volume. The total number of minutes that young people are reading. Reading volume is the measure of your eyes on a text. How much reading are you doing? The effective classrooms, the effective schools research shows that on average, elementary, middle, and high school, on average, in effective classrooms and effective schools, students average 90 minutes a day, eyes on text. 90 minutes a day. I did not say free voluntary reading. 90 minutes a day, a variety of tasks of getting them to read. However, in the pandemic, we're not seeing that same reading volume. So we're not seeing 90 minutes a day on average. So if we could ask parents for a little help, the first thing I would ask for is reading volume. Can you get this child, the young person, to practice so that the amazing instruction can stick? In addition, we should have some read-alouds. Reading a lot builds your knowledge background, etc. We can also read aloud to kids, and I'm not just limiting this to the night before, you know, they go to bed, you know, that time. We can read aloud across the whole day. We can read aloud to children all day long. Share the news. Share a recipe. Show them how you read. So we're not asking teachers to teach five-year-olds to teach them to read. We're asking parents to support this. How do we get reading volume up? How do we get all of that language up so that the practice can stick? There's research evidence 10, 12 years ago that if a child reads to a pet or a stuffed animal, or in this case, a finger puppet, their fluency increases and their confidence in reading increases. So one of the things we started telling families through the teachers, if your child could read it aloud to the dog, the cat, the fish, the stuffed animal, whatever, every single day, it will grow that child's fluency and confidence. So this teacher was talking to us about this, and she bought these little eggs. They have little finger puppets in them, 24 of them for $18 on Amazon. She wrote Study Buddy on them, and she gave them in a pickup party to her students. So your thing said $1,800. Super funny. It's $18. There we go. And so she gave them to families to give to kids to raise the reading volume. And then we asked families, once a week, could you capture a clip of your child reading out loud? It would be amazing for us to use it as progress monitoring if we could hear your child once a week read out loud. But don't do it just for the video. Have the kid read every day out loud.
And I'll offer, as we look at this video, the voice is a little bit soft, so you may want to turn your volume up.
Just jump in there somewhere in the middle, Nancy.
Not a box. Box, not with a box, not with a house, not with a box, and not eat them anywhere.
All right. Can you pause it? So imagine that you could get parents to do this. Could you get parents, maybe not all of them, some of them, to collect short clips of their child reading for the teacher to use as progress monitoring? And any kid that we get a video clip from, that's one less student we have to assess in synchronous learning time. And we'll save our synchronous learning time for instruction and not assessment. Teachers need assessment information. Teachers need data to monitor progress and make adjustments to instruction. So I hope that if parents, if families could provide this for us, they might just have more time on instruction with the teacher. The next video clip I'm going to show you is based on our work called Teach Back. We're creating all kinds of teach back opportunities. Parents have to support this. In this case, the student's going to do a teach back to her classmates, but we're also seeing all kinds of teach back to families, to grandparents on Zoom, all kinds of the ways. What if we built a culture that students had to teach back things they learned as a way for the teachers to understand? So let's take a listen to her, and then I'll debrief some things I notice.
Hello, class. So we are going to compare numbers, and the numbers we are comparing are 436,425 and 450,123. So the bigger one would be this one, because the alligator wanted to eat it. The reason why the alligator would want to eat this number is because you easily see the 4 and then the 4. They're equal. But you would go to the next one and there's a 3. And then there's a 5. 5 and 3 are not equal. So you would go to the one that's bigger, and you would put the alligator, and then you would circle it. And if you ever have another problem like this, and these are staying equal but the last one isn't, then you have found your answer of which one's bigger. So thank you so much for watching How to Compare a Number.
And then the next one will come up, and then the next one will come up, the next one will come up. It's done on Flipgrid. So Nancy, you can pause that. If we create a culture of teach back and we capture some of these videos, now the teachers know what's stuck and where we still need to go. So as a little temperature check for us, would you be willing to put in the chat the best thing you've heard so far? Something that you're finding valuable that you can take back to your community, your school. What's the most valuable thing you've heard so far? 90 minutes of reading, creating a culture of teach back, thank you. Reading volume, the Flipgrid to teach back, family media plan, thank you, and teach back. Focus on reading volume, teach back, maintaining routines, reading volume at home, thank you, simple. Simplify things for families.
You know, Doug, one of the things I was saying is that I think so often that families minimize what it is that they really contribute to their children's learning. And I hope that some of these conversations that you all are having with families that you work with as well are reassuring to them that that the things that they're doing are really important, whether it is creating routines, making sure that sleep happens, doing some read-alouds with your child, all of those things contribute immeasurably to their learning.
Yes, thank you. All right, we'll continue on with a few more ideas. Our belief, we've talked about this, Nancy and I, for years and years. If you're not struggling, if you're not engaged in productive struggle, you're probably not learning. if an hour goes by and there are no errors and no one's struggling, you probably already knew all this stuff anyway. So we have worked with families here to get them to guide their children, not tell them things. So if you could get a message to families, here would be a message I think your teachers would love. In your own words, however kind and growth-producing you can make it, here's a message for families. Please allow your child to struggle. Struggle is good for their brains. Productive struggle is how they learn. Please do not do the work for your child. And please do not tell your child the answers. What we are seeing is widespread parents shouting out answers during Zoom and Team and Google meetings. We are not playing Jeopardy in your living room. We are trying to learn things. Now, let me be clear on this. My perspective is these are well-meaning, well-intended parents, family members who want to help us. And they think helping us is telling their kid answers. And it's not helping. And I'll tell you, it is a source of significant frustration for teachers who are in the middle of a lesson, watching the thinking happen, working with the children in the class, and all of a sudden the lesson falls apart. I have a personal trainer. She comes over and stands in the driveway with a mask on and makes me do things. Keeps me active during the pandemic. She has two kids. She's a former software engineer. She cannot help herself but shout out answers in math. Language arts, she's good. All the other stuff. Math, she has to remove herself and go outside because it's too frustrating because she wants to help, over help. Nancy, next slide. So if we could get a message to parents, when your child is doing independent work, practice work, you can give them all the hints you want. Hint, 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 wink, 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 no problem. Don't tell them the answers and don't do the work for them. If the child struggles so much that your hints don't help, let the teacher know and we'll do some additional small group instruction with your child. But please be careful. If you keep telling kids the answers, they will develop learned helplessness. They will become adult dependent. And I promise you, undoing learned helplessness will be way harder than repairing any losses of learning that have occurred. Undoing learned helplessness has proven to be very, very difficult. Another area, practice. Please, parents, when the teacher gives kids things to do for practice, please get them to do the practice. Practice makes learning permanent, not perfect. They have to engage in sufficient practice. Here's a model of, I think we've all understood, we all agree. If you want to learn to play the banjo or the drums or soccer or hockey or whatever else you see up there, it requires practice. And parents, you take your kid to piano lessons. You take your kid to soccer practice. Practice, 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 practice. On the chance they might get to play the game. The same is true in academics. Deliberate practice is important. Here's a model of deliberate practice all the way to the right. That young person needs to develop a mental model of expertise. What does it look like to play soccer? What does it look like to add numbers? What does it look like to read informational text? A mental model of expertise. By and large, that comes from their teachers. When they have a mental model of expertise, they are way more likely to receive and respond to the feedback, focus on the activities for their practice, work towards a goal, and engage in struggle. We have to build practice activities for students. Parents, we need your help. We're not doing the work for them and we're not skipping them. There's a reason why the teacher is giving the child practice. Here's the model of learning. Acquisition. acquiring skills, acquiring concepts, by and large occurs through instruction. When the teachers teach things, by and large, that is through instruction, through acquisition. To move something from acquisition to consolidation requires practice. Learning it, acquiring it, learning it, by and large, instruction. But to do something consistently requires practice. To move from consolidation to maintenance requires more practice. And then finally, to move to transfer or generalization, it requires more practice. Teachers can get students to acquire. That's not a problem. I can help your child acquire skills, concepts, knowledge. But to get it owned, to transfer and generalize, to maintain it a long time, requires that this young person engages in practice over and over and over. I didn't say rote, boring things. I did not say shut up sheets, those kinds of things. But the meaningful practice that builds the skill set from acquisition all the way to transfer. So another chat question for you. What can we do to ensure that students gain sufficient practice? Such that their learning sticks. Sorry for my typo there. What can we do to ensure that students gain sufficient practice such that the learning sticks? So if you think about this, how can you communicate with families? How can you support families to understand the role that practice plays in their child's learning? And how can we make sure that's actually happening if we're teaching remotely or blended or distance learning? So what's on your mind about that? Yes, build it into the schedule. Awesome. Build it right into your Seesaw page or whatever. Here's when we're supposed to practice. Mm-hmm. Build learning time, independent learning time, in for the students. Yes, I see that, Charlotte. Thank you, Jasmine. Other ideas. Create paired learning opportunities between families during small group time. Get them to practice. Shared instruction provides time with independent practice. Make it engaging. Balance some novelty with it so that it's not all rote practice. Mm-hmm. Create choice boards for practice. I like that, Jennifer. We have to figure this one out. Courageous conversations with parents regarding the norms for independent practice. Let them play games with their learning. I believe the schools, classrooms that make it in distance learning, blended learning, remote learning, will be the schools that figure out the practice effect. By and large, distance learning instruction is really good. It's way different from what it was in the spring during crisis. But if we don't get students to practice, this amazing instruction is not going to stick. Monitor, be interactive with them. We've got to get students to engage in practice.
I really like the idea too that that came through the chat about making sure that parents and the children understand what the purpose of practice is, especially in being able to label it as such. And I think sometimes both children as well as families kind of think that the things that we have them doing asynchronously are not really practice, that it's busy work of one kind or another. I'm thinking about, Doug, what you talked about earlier, that in the effective schools research, that in a across the day, that children have eyes on print for 90 minutes a day. That's practice. That's what it is that's happening. When we don't have the opportunity to be able to kind of oversee the entire school day in a live session, we have to shift some of that kind of practice work into asynchronous. And so I think having those conversations and saying, here's why it is that that work is there. It isn't busy work. It's practice, and it's going to advance their learning. I think that creates a whole different conversation.
Yep.
The last section that we'll talk about today is around well-being, around student well-being, around family well-being. And this, of course, is a major concern to anybody who's involved in the education of children, whether you're talking about your own personal children, whether you're talking about the children that you're honored to be able to serve in schools. Their well-being, their social emotional well-being, remains something that is a continuous conversation among families as well. And we kind of see these sort of chunking out into three particular areas: concerns around socialization, concerns around friendship, and concerns around conflict resolution. And many times these are all kind of embedded or nested one into the other. In terms of socialization, I think it is helpful at times to be able to remind families that children are socializing in different ways right now, that in many cases we're not able to have those same kinds of face-to-face play opportunities, for example, especially as the cold weather will be setting in soon in the northern parts of the United States, there's going to be a lot more limitations on how it is that we can even get children together in a face-to-face environment and do so safely. So it's important to remind families that kids do socialize in different ways, and that some of that includes things like some social media, playing videos together online. I have a couple of grandchildren that are all either elementary or middle school age, and meeting their friends online to be able to play Fortnite or some of those other video games that are popular with children right now is becoming a really important outlet. And I think that that's where some of that balance ends up having to be in terms of screen time and how it is that screen time is being utilized. I know two of my my grandchildren will have watch parties with some of their friends, and they'll all watch a movie together. You know, and I heard about last weekend that some of them got together and they all watched one of the Lego movies together again. They're socializing and connecting with others in different ways, and we have to acknowledge the fact that that's happening right now, and that that isn't necessarily always a negative. With friendships too, children may be experiencing some estrangement. They miss their friends. They miss that kind of contact that they have with them. And that can kind of flow into conflict of one kind or another. They see each other less. They get fewer opportunities to be able to talk with one another. And some of that conflict resolution that children might be able to do in a face-to-face environment becomes much more awkward and much more difficult for them to be able to do. Again, the family influence is enormous in this regard, especially around conflict resolution. If you're having conflict, your child is having conflict with a friend, for example, being able to kind of walk them through a problem solving that includes, and we all know this from being educators, starting out with that social emotional learning, being able to label your feelings, for example. How is it that you're feeling right now? Helping them to kind of push the pause button and understand that sometimes you need to be able to take a little bit of time with that. As we all know too, it's important not to minimize the problems that children may have. It can be easy, especially for all of us feeling the strain and being overworked ourselves, to say to your child, for example, oh, you know, get over it. It'll be okay. You'll be fine. And children don't necessarily get over it in one day. So those sensitivities that we bring to the conversations that happen in the home can be really important. Again, I think families don't always give themselves as much credit as they deserve for how it is that their children learn not only academically, but socially and emotionally as well. The ways in which we model how it is that we solve our own problems is an essential part of this as well. So having those conversations with families, you know, what do you do when there's a conflict, for example, between two siblings? How is it that you help them to understand how they're going to talk with one another, how they are going to perhaps take a pause or take a break from one another and then come back together again? Those are all important things that happen inside of the home and that help to inform children about what it is that they do in maintaining and repairing the relationships that they have.
You know, Nancy, I was thinking about this, like if there's five-year-olds having a conflict in kindergarten class, the mm-hmm. grown-ups help them work through that. When there's a little relational bullying in a fifth grade class, or there's some meanness on the playground, we help them work through that. This is going to be one of the hardest areas for educators to help. And I think the messaging to families is, we're working on the education, we're working on the academics and the social emotional learning, but socialization and friendships, we're having a really hard time with. Yes, we can have some social time in our Zoom meetings, but we really need you to continue the socialization opportunities that are safe, the friendship opportunities, and to let your kid resolve conflicts as they occur. Because this is an area that we're just not having as much access at this point to those kinds of situations for learning.
We have a great conversation, or a great question rather, that it's posed to us about discipline in online chats. And I assume that you mean, in the conversation about that, the online chats that are happening, within school, within that, school environment in particular. And, it comes down to, I believe, the same things that we do as educators in a face-to-face environment. What are the norms mm-hmm. that you're co-constructing with children? What are the ways in which we talk with one another? There's modeling for that as well. And then when there are violations of one kind or another, how is it that we help children to be able to resolve those conflicts? One of the things that is the mark of a great educator is in having unconditional positive regard for children. In other words, every day is a new day. We're not going to hold Tuesday against you forever. But we do need to be able to resolve those problems. And those can be ways in which we mirror for families how it is that we resolve conflicts when there are conflicts that happen among school children, to be able to create some of that consistency. I know that there are probably some other questions that are out there. We'd love to hear from you, please pose them in the chat.
We hope that the resource, the portal, as we called it, that Nancy showed you is useful for you. Go grab all those PowerPoints, cannibalize them, have at them. You can make a book club or a webinar or a presentation, whatever you need. Oh, Nancy, what's the responsibility of parents in disciplining?
Well, and so again, I'm going to read into that question and let me know if that's not correct. I think one of the things that we're seeing is that kind of blurring of lines is when there are disputes in school, in distance learning, and perhaps a family member wants to get immediately involved in all of that. And I think it's important to be able to articulate how it is proactively that we go about being able to solve those problems for students so that families know that we've got this. We will help to be able to take care of this because we do have incidences where, you know, an adult's walking through and they hear another child that says something and now that parent wants to get involved with what the conversation is. So I think proactively us talking about how it is that we handle disputes, how it is that we resolve conflicts when they occur during our school session, helps to alleviate some of the responsibilities that parents might otherwise feel that they need to do in order to be able to support their child, or, you know, in other cases, perhaps discipline their child in ways that are not necessarily productive.
So Jasmine, you ask about teachers who are not getting used to so much feedback from parents, and that's causing some stress, and they need some processing time. They need to reflecting, processing time. What was the feedback? You know, what was happening? So Nancy and I have both done a lot of processing with teachers about the things they're hearing from parents, from sometimes students, but mostly from parents. I also see Jennifer's comment about Spanish dominant and family struggle with virtual learning. And so I think if we can get some information out, you know, some recorded videos on how this system works, here's how you provide access for your child, etc.
And that's one of the reasons why we really wanted to start off with, like, what are the basics? What are things that you can do that are of high value for students to be able to utilize? You don't need to necessarily do everything that's in there, but we want to be able to at least capture those high value things.
So Nancy and Doug, I hate to even stop you because you have given us so many great ideas. I love it when we have a webinar and with practical suggestions that people can take away and go implement them immediately. So you all did a wonderful job, and thank you so much for providing that great portal as a resource for all the participants today. It was great seeing you. Last time I saw you, Doug, we were in Wyoming.
I know.
The storm was coming in. Do you remember that?
That's right. That's right. We were in Wyoming. The old days when you got on airplanes and you stayed in hotels and all those things.
I know. It was about a year ago today, but it seems like ages. So great to see you both again. And thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.